Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in East Asian Studies, podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel, coming to you today from a very snowy Sapporo in Japan. On the podcast today, we have Anne Reinhart, Professor of History at Williams College in Massachusetts, who will be talking about her book, Navigating Semi-Colonialism, Shipping, Sovereignty, and Nation Building in China, 1860 to 1937, which is published this year, 2018, by Harvard University Asia Center. Now, trade between China and the outside world is rarely out of the news these days, whether we're discussing the now long-standing expansion of Chinese business and goods into global markets, or more recent developments like the US-China trade tensions that are unfolding as we speak. But for a long time, of course, global trade moved in other directions, as Western countries and Japan employed a mix of coercion and collaboration to foist their wares and business priorities on China, and dominated the country's trade and customs. Anne Reinhart's new book, Navigating Semi-Colonialism, focuses on these very dynamics, and specifically the place of steam shipping as an index of the political, economic, and social processes which unfolded in China between the mid-19th and mid-20th centuries. In Reinhart's telling, trade in China's coastal and inland waters and the very vessels on which this was conducted become sites where much grander processes crystallize in physical space. The author covers a long period richly revealing in the shifts in relationships and hierarchies which occurred among Chinese and non-Chinese actors over time. Reading this work of quite amazing depth and scope, we're left in little doubt regarding the importance of steam shipping as what Reinhart herself calls a means of interrogating China's experience of Euro-American and Japanese colonialism. From close-at-hand specifics about what was going on in commercial boardrooms, government departments, and below deck, Reinhart takes us elegantly to higher levels of elevation too, revealing the place of steam shipping within global developments in trade, transport, and technology as global modernity took shape. In sum, this multi-level approach offers us fresh, nuanced ways of understanding what semi-colonialism itself was and of perceiving the long legacy of this experience, which to this day informs relations between China and the outside world. But in any case, without further ado, I'll say Anne Reinhart, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much for agreeing to appear. And I greatly enjoyed the book and I'm looking forward to talking about it. But before we do, perhaps I could just start by asking you about yourself and your background and how you became interested in China and history and so on.
I got interested in Chinese studies mostly through an interest in language studies when I was in high school. So when I started college, I started studying Japanese, actually, and sort of backed into Asian studies. And then from there, got very interested in China and Chinese history. And then went on and did an MA in Asian studies and a PhD in history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where was it you studied?
Oh, sorry. My BA is from Harvard, MA from UC Berkeley, and PhD from Princeton.
And what was it about the particular period that we cover in covered in this book that attracted you?
When I was in grad school, it was sort of the at least as I remember, it was kind of the height of post-colonial studies in history departments, I think, that a lot of people were talking about subaltern studies, et cetera. And I felt like there was a lot of space to bring some of those insights into Chinese studies, even though it wasn't really something that at that time people were talking about a lot in Chinese studies. Of course, in the interim, that those kind of investigations have expanded quite a lot. But that was what got me started on that.
Mm-hmm. And actually, well, one real rich sort of strength of the book is the way that it teases out some of these relationships between broader post-colonial and colonial discourses and what occurred in China, which, as we'll go into, was in many regards somewhat more complicated than how those themes have been discussed elsewhere. Was it the case that the book came directly out of your PhD then? Or
yeah, this is my PhD dissertation, basically expanded somewhat, but yes.
It doesn't. I'd alert listeners to the fact that it doesn't read like like many PhD dissertations that I have seen, and indeed probably like the one I wrote.
that's very kind of you.
Certainly, a good deal more engaging and readable than that kind of thing. But great. Well, once now we know something of where it came from, why don't we get right into it?
Sure.
So you begin the book as a whole sort of moves chronologically through time. Starting, as I mentioned in the intro, in the mid-19th century and coming forward, although 1937 is the sort of stated end date in the title there, we do actually come forward up to the sort of mid-20th, giving us a really great historical span there. But in the introduction, you sort of outline the key terms that shape the book and kind of recur through the periods that you're discussing. So it seems like a sort of pretty obvious question to start with, but could you perhaps give us a bit of an outline of the shipping situation you focus on here and why it is that it provides such a revealing lens through which to look at China's semi-colonial experience and the emergence of nationalism and concerns over sovereignty?
Sure. Obviously, the European traders who came to China were at the time when their access to China was restricted to a single port. They were completely dependent on ships. So it sort of forms the backbone of that trade structure of Westerners, East India Company, et cetera, coming to China. And then as after the Opium Wars, as the trade system developed a little bit more, ships obviously remain important in that. One of the things that I learned when I was doing the research for this was that traffic among the treaty ports was almost an unintended consequence of opening up more than one. But that became a kind of structure that became very profitable for Western traders to use their ships to carry goods among the open ports. And it took the Qing government a while to kind of catch on that this was going on. But then once that was happening, the Qing government had a very hard time turning back to, you can only come in and out of a certain port. So the circulation among the treaty ports sort of forms a network that after the Second Opium War, after the 1860s, becomes dominated by steamships rather than sailing ships. So before that time, it had been cheaper to use sail to go back and forth between China and places abroad. But once the Yangtze River was open, then it became worthwhile to do this to both purchase steamships, which were really expensive for this, as well as to fuel them, which was also expensive and sort of hard to do. But then once that was in place, the treaty ports themselves become a transport network. So again, they're not just those outposts where Westerners can trade, but they're these sort of important nodes in a shipping network. And as Westerners open more and more treaty ports or press the Qing to open more and more treaty ports, then that shipping network grows as well. So what I learned as I was, sort of following the story along was that shipping was in itself really a mode of expansion into China, into the Chinese interior.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, so that picture emerges really clearly from in the early part of the book that we'll move on to shortly from the point where Guangzhou Canton is the sole place where outside shipping can get in and trade, to a broader picture where other ports are available. You mentioned there just the kind of interactive dynamics a little between the Qing and the outside powers, Britain in particular at the start, in trying to open up more opportunities for trade. This brings us quite neatly onto, I guess, one of the key framing ideas of the whole book, namely semi-colonialism, which is a term associated with China's 19th and early 20th century history, of course, a great deal. You have a really fascinating presentation of what this means to you and how you are theorizing this in the book, looking, as you say, at both sides of the hyphen, both the semi part and the colonialism part. Could you flesh this out and sort of explain to us how you understand semi-colonialism in the context of this book and more broadly?
Yes. People have often said to me, you know, well, this is the way the Chinese state talks about this. You know, are you sure you want to use this term, and so on and so forth? And I am using it a little bit against the grain of that semi-feudal, semi-colonial kind of formulation, where I'm just ignoring the semi-feudal part of it and looking at the situation in China in which you do have foreign expansion into a Chinese territory, and the sort of some impingement of Chinese sovereignty, but at the same time, the original government is left intact. And again, for me, it felt important. I mean, there are people who would argue that you really don't need the semi part of it. Let's just talk about this all as a larger category of colonialism. But I do feel like if you do that, you lose a lot of the nuance of what that kind of margin of preserved Qing sovereignty meant for the shaping of the relationship between China and the outside powers. And in my book, it's primarily Britain that I'm looking at. Eventually, Japan comes into the picture too. But I do also, I think it's significant that Britain was the power that really shaped the treaty system the most in the period that I'm looking at. So what I was trying to get at was, you know, why that sort of margin of sovereignty still mattered. At the same time, without denying, like taking it to the other extreme and saying somehow, well, because China was semi-colonialism, had semi-colonial rule, then somehow it wasn't really colonized, right? Just to sort of take away some of the kind of moral charge that I think we associate with colonialism, because I think you can see many very similar kind of processes going on in China as you can see in countries that are essentially, you know, the formal colonies of another power. So again, I use the term because it allows me to look at the both and rather than, you know, either or. If we used a different kind of term, like I kind of dismiss the idea of informal empire as a useful term of that, because I think that this sort of gets at the broader situation that I was interested in.
Right, right. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think the distinctions that you're making there between semi-colonial and more broadly colonial dynamics come out with periodic, really fruitful comparison with India in particular. You mentioned that Britain is significant, that Britain is a major player, and I guess India as a former colony makes a very productive counterpart to the Qing experience. And in terms of the Qing and the interaction with Britain, and as you mentioned later, Japan, you discuss this in terms of collaboration. So yes. This, I guess, gets us into this question of the limits of action, the kind of constrained sovereignty, perhaps, that the Qing dynasty had over Chinese territory at this time. What is collaboration kind of for you? How does this term help us understand what was going on?
Yeah, no, and it's another term that's I imagine is going to get me in some trouble as I talk more about the book. But when I'm using the term collaboration, not to talk about, again, the kind of collaboration that we usually associate with kind of wartime situation, you know, collaboration with the Japanese in China, and so on. But I took it from, you know, old theories of imperialism from Ronald Robinson's idea of collaboration, where he was basically making the argument that that some imperial formations are contingent on a kind of collaboration between the power coming in from the outside and the existing sort of government within within each particular place. And I found it useful because it was very difficult as I did this research. I found it very difficult to be able to look at the agency of the Qing government in a very black and white manner, meaning that it was hard to see the Qing as either completely resisting the incursions of foreign powers into China or as completely cooperating with that. And what I liked collaboration because it kind of allowed me to describe some of the different dynamics that went into that. So the times at which you can see the Qing working very consciously to try to limit what foreign powers can do in China, as well as these times when, you know, they might like to do that, but they are really under duress and really can't do that. And so this term collaboration sort of allowed me to talk about both of those dynamics. So, I mean, I think, you know, sometimes I don't know, in older Chinese historiography, I think they would sort of say the Qing was completely cooperating with the foreign powers. But what I saw a lot of attempts at very kind of attempts to really hem in what the foreign powers could do in China through the sort of early part of the treaty system. And so I was kind of trying to capture the way that that worked, the way that they could resist, but then also at times be somewhat overwhelmed by the kind of the asymmetries in power that that they experienced.
And in that sense, that both collaboration and semi-colonialism, as you flesh them out in the introduction there, give names to something that, as you then kind of explain, is a pretty complicated concept or pretty complicated set of dynamics. So I think that's really, really helpful for setting us up regarding what the book basically, the points the book makes as it goes through. But of course, the Qing is not the only sort of point of concern as the book proceeds. And we move into the nationalist period that succeeded the Qing after 1911, 1912. How was it that these dynamics of collaboration and semi-colonial experience shaped the nationalist agenda and the resistance, kind of more widespread resistance to foreign encroachment that followed the Qing?
The sort of feature of that period is kind of suffused with this nationalist rhetoric. Once the Qing is gone, then in a way there's very little mediation between, say, the foreign powers and their critics in China. So that obviously, as we all know, the kind of nationalist rhetoric is much stronger and much, much more direct. But also at that time, because you have a clear idea of China as a nation, the asymmetries between, foreign steamship companies in China and Chinese steamship companies within China become much, much more pronounced. They become much more evident. So I think that then sort of further fuels this kind of nationalist rhetoric and the idea of sort of kicking out the foreign powers in order to establish a Chinese nation.
I see. Well, that's kind of.
So in a way, I mean, just to kind of be clear about, I'm not sure that completely answered your question, but that in a way, collaboration is less relevant in the Republic, even though it does still happen to some degree. It's less of something that really governs this, that you don't have quite as much the same kind of pressure of expansion that you have in the Qing period, and you have a lot more outspoken resistance. at that time.
Okay. Right. No, that's something that you bring out really clearly and really gives us a very strong sense of the key distinctions and the key shifts in really dynamics across the whole of society that occurred as the Qing moved into, or the, well, as the Qing didn't move anywhere, the Qing just collapsed, but as China moved into a post-imperial or a sort of gradually de-imperializing era. But we can jump really now, I think, into the actual the chapters of the book itself. I think you've got a sense of how it's set up. You begin by going into more detail about the operation of the treaty ports, the expansion that you already mentioned of European interests into these ports in China that are secured as specifically privileged areas where foreign powers are allowed to trade, because the Qing kept a sort of pretty tight, well, at least desired to keep a pretty tight control over where outsiders were allowed to come in. Could you go into more detail perhaps about the treaty ports that are such a key part of China's colonial experience and the role of shipping within that? I mean, how it was that shipping was embedded in this expansion of interest in locations for trade across China?
Yeah. How should we say? So very soon after the Qing, and this is right after the Second Opium War, the Treaty of Tianjin, very soon after the Qing says that it's going to allow foreign flag ships to circulate among the treaty ports, it also makes a move to basically insist that foreign flag ships can only travel between treaty ports, that Western ship owners always wanted to take their ships everywhere, right, within China. And they kept arguing that they should have, you know, along with free trade, a kind of free navigation of China's inland waters. But the Qing kind of uses the institution of a treaty port to limit that, to say, no, really the only places that you can stop your ships are in ports that have been formally opened by treaties, so that those treaty ports take on, they're not only kind of trade centers, they take on the importance of being kind of the key ports in a shipping network. And as the first steamships in China were all foreign steamships, for the most part, that were foreign flag steamships, then that network of treaty ports becomes sort of synonymous with steam navigation as well. So you have a situation in which, you know, you can take a steamship between Shanghai and Zhenjiang, a little bit further up the Yangtze River, but that steamship can't stop at any places in between. So that both kind of gives additional importance to those ports, because they now have a new transport function in addition to whatever trade function they might have originally been intended for. And in a lot of cases, it's the shipping that becomes the important part that port plays in foreign trade. So again, Zhenjiang being an example of a port that had very little trade of its own and was mostly important as a kind of place that the surrounding area could send their goods, gather their goods to then be shipped via steamship somewhere else.
I see. And the discussion of the sort of push up the Yangtze, I think, is one really interesting early part of the narrative that you relate. The ports like Zhenjiang, at least, you know, in today's China, that there are quite a few of these places that are not so prominent anymore. And it's interesting to look at how the shifts. I used to live, or spent a couple of years living in Wuhan, and
yes,
Hankou is another of the main ports, one of the three cities that makes up Wuhan. Is somewhere that has retained some importance, but these sort of shifts in power and in prominence in national conversation are very interesting. But could you say a little more about how that sort of push up the Yangtze, which really is a sort of blood vessel running right through the center of the country, proceeded? And particularly what I enjoyed was the narrative about getting up all the way up to Chongqing, way into the interior. How did the sort of to and fro and the collaborative dynamics between Qing and outside forces proceed in that Yangtze basin area?
Yes. Well, once after 1860, after the Treaty of Tianjin is implemented, then foreigners suddenly had a lot more freedom to travel within China than they had had in the past. So at that point in the early 1860s, you have many, many sort of expeditions going up the Yangtze looking for these transport routes that would link China with India. So it would link China, say, with British possessions in India. And so there was a lot of what we might think of as almost sort of exploration of mapping of the Yangtze that happened kind of early in the period that I look at. And in that time, some of those observers saw Chongqing as this very rich and lively port. And so it became kind of part of an expansionist narrative that, you know, the real China is just a little deeper inland than we've gotten so far, so that there was more and more pressure from commercial organizations on the kind of diplomatic British diplomatic bodies in China to open more and more ports further and further up the Yangtze with the hope of being able to tap this trade that these observers had initially seen at Chongqing. Now, again, Chongqing is a very, always was a very kind of lively trading location, of, as we know, but I think it became almost a way of sort of saving the China trade for, or a kind of dream of, if we could only get that far, we could sort of redeem the poor performance of this trade. And so there was a lot of kind of political pressure, particularly from these sorts of chambers of commerce and other kinds of commercial organizations, British commercial organizations, to open more of the river to foreign trade, in particular with the goal of reaching Chongqing. And as the 19th century wore on, and there were more kind of incidents that, for example, I'm losing the name right now, but, you know, incidents where foreign travelers in China were killed by local people, or things that could be used, diplomatic incidents that could be used to pressure the Qing. The demands would always be, well, let's open another port, one more port further upriver, one more port further upriver. And so that was used, those pretexts were used as a way of extending that steam network all the way to Chongqing. Of course, there were also some technological difficulties in the way. They had to develop steamships that could go through the Yangtze Gorges area, which was notoriously difficult to navigate. But it was, I think, you know, mostly it was a kind of commercial imperative to get up there. And at the same time, the Qing was quite concerned about letting foreigners as far inland as Chongqing. There had been quite a number of very sort of violent anti-Christian incidents in Sichuan. And so they were afraid, well, if the steam network extends that far, then we'll open ourselves up to all kinds of other pressure from the foreign powers. And so they tried various means of kind of keeping curtailing that expansion. So they'd say, well, you know, okay, you can have Chongqing as a treaty port, and this is in the 1890s, but you can't bring steamships up there until a Chinese steamship has gone that far. So they would sometimes kind of try to put obstacles in the way of that expansion.
I see, yeah. And that kind of to and fro constant negotiation and pushing and resistance and then concessions and using excuses, as you mentioned, foreign powers using excuses to grab more stuff, having if one of their people, who probably shouldn't have been wherever they were in the first place, is killed. So that brings out this kind of really complex and far from unidirectional dynamic that we discussed there in terms of collaboration and the sort of partial retention of Qing sovereignty. And actually, these kind of slightly sort of feral expeditions by roving geographers and surveyors remind me slightly actually of the last interview I did with Judd Kinsley, talking about Xinjiang and how Russian surveyors and geographers were poking into China at exactly the same time. And then later kind of being, attempts were made to incorporate what they had found and their activities into this kind of slightly enfeebled Qing Qing governmental structure. So on that theme, we might move on to the next couple of chapters, 2 and 3, which really go into more detail about how the business operated.
Yes. The
actual shipping companies in this kind of rather informal, haphazard way at the beginning, and then how it was formalized to some extent more from the 1880s.
Yes.
Could you say something about how this process unfolded in terms of the actual business organization, and particularly the collaboration that what's called the shipping conference, right, that emerged as foreign companies and notionally Chinese companies started to cooperate?
Yes. So I think just to be very brief and schematic, in the very early years of steam navigation in China, most of the companies, or say, let's say the flags that steamships were flying, were foreign flags, and they were mostly either British or American. But the capital that was invested in the steamship business was both European/American and Chinese, that quite a few Chinese, often compradors, but also just sort of large merchants in the treaty ports, invested rather heavily in the steamship business. And the foreign companies depended very much on this Chinese capital for their, in order to be able to finance bringing these ships to China and so on. And it was for the Chinese merchants, it was a way, investing in these companies was a way of kind of hiding some of their wealth from the state. So so there was this, I use a word that the North China Herald used to describe that sort of business structure. They called these the cosmopolitan companies because the flag didn't necessarily match the capital that was involved in those companies. But then in the 1870s, that sort of much more kind of hybrid, those sort of hybrid companies begin to disappear, and that they're supplanted by companies where there's a much closer alignment between the capital invested in the company and the flag that the ships fly. And that happens for two reasons. And one is that British shipping, especially steam shipping, really takes off worldwide. And there's a lot of interest in Britain in investing in steamship companies. And these British companies that are completely capitalized by British investors in Britain, as opposed to treaty port investors in China, come to China, and they have a lot of backing, a lot of power, and they're able to sort of defeat many of the sort of cosmopolitan rivals that were initially there. And at the same time that you get that shift towards British shipping and British capital, the Qing sponsors the formation of the China Merchants Steam Navigation Company. And that was supposed to be a company that would take back the shipping in the interior of China from foreign companies and bring it back under Chinese control, so that the China Merchants Company, you had to be Chinese to invest in it. It was supposed to be supported, you know, sort of generally supported by the state, but run by Chinese merchants. And that the idea was it could, they felt like they could make that company strong enough that they could sort of kick out foreign companies. Now, by the end of the 1870s, it's clear that that's not going to happen, that that most of those cosmopolitan companies have fallen away. And then the field is kind of reduced to two rather strong British firms, one run by the trading firm Butterfield and Swire, and the other run by Jardine Matheson and Company, and the Chinese China Merchants Steam Navigation Company. So those three are competing, and they're competing rather viciously along in the treaty port network with one another. And in the late 1870s and early 1880s, they decide that they're going to resolve this competition by joining together in a shipping conference. And a shipping conference is a sort of, it's almost a way of kind of cartelizing the shipping business. It's that these companies, they get together, they decide what they're going to charge for rates. They often will divide the business among themselves, saying, okay, well, for you people going from between Shanghai and Guangzhou, you're going to do these many sailings, somebody else is going to do these many sailings, and then they'll pool and split the profits from those as well. So it's essentially, you know, an organization that that controls the business, and it's by cooperating, they can keep new competitors out. So conferences are a feature of 19th century shipping in general, especially overseas shipping. But there's a kind of key figure, a guy who was both involved, very involved in the overseas, British overseas networks, as well as who had, who was sort of in charge of a shipping company in China, who was a big promoter of conferences. And so it's really sort of on his, or sort of with his promoting of this idea of the conference, that there's one that's set up between the two British firms and the China Merchants Steam Navigation Company. So that's a lot of detailed background, but the argument that my book makes about that conference is to talk about that as a different form of collaboration than the one that I was talking about earlier between, say, the Qing state and expanding foreign powers. And that is a way in which this conference, or the China Merchants Company joining this conference, has a variety of effects that it's very difficult to kind of reduce it down to either, you know, they empowered or disempowered the company. It did both. So by joining with these British companies, the China Merchants Company, on the one hand, had to give up at that original intention it had to kind of take back the rivers and coasts of China from these foreign firms, because now it was essentially sort of joining with them to control that business. But at the same time, by the end of the 1870s, the China Merchants Company had expanded very, very quickly. It was really deeply in debt. It was kind of on the verge of financial collapse. So joining in this conference allowed it to, you know, take advantage of the support that a conference organization offers. And it allowed it really to survive all the way until, I mean, in my book, it survives all the way until the Second World War, but we still have versions of the China Merchants Company with us today. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, so on the one hand, it had almost given up its sort of proto-nationalist mission. But on the other hand, having done that, it kept the Chinese flag represented in those interior networks in China for the long term. And so, again, the book goes into kind of greater detail about how that collaboration worked. But another feature of it, the reason that I also think of it as collaboration, is there's a sort of major asymmetry between the British firms and the China Merchants Company. And that has to do with the British firms were very closely connected with overseas British shipping and could sort of take advantage of their connections to overseas British shipping and finance to build their company in China, while the China Merchants Company didn't have that kind of access. And so over time, we see that the British companies grow and grow, and the China Merchants Company becomes sort of a little bit of a shell of its former self, because it simply doesn't have the same kind of position and the same kind of access to overseas shipping as these other companies have. Those are sort of some of the dynamics that make up the sense in which I'm writing about the shipping conference as a form of collaboration.
Right. No, that it's a really intriguing picture of how these sorts of relationships between foreign and Qing power worked. And I think at least this window of time, this particular situation, does lend itself in some senses to the kind of later analysis, where it's semi-feudal and semi-colonial, in that you seem to have these fat cats of various nationalities banding together, and you know, it's almost, you can see that more of a class analysis applies to some extent there than just the straightforward colonial kind of foreign versus Chinese analysis. But in any case, as you mentioned, it's also a deeply asymmetrical context. And you mentioned, we won't have time to go into detail about this now, but you discussed the impact of the increasing involvement of Japanese companies later on at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th. We could sort of flag that up as something that that listeners ought to go and investigate, because that's another very intriguing dimension to this. But as we sort of move on, you discuss the sort of asymmetries of power dynamics and the operation of the companies themselves. But moving into chapter four, where you start looking at the steamship as a social space, mm-hmm. as you put it, what was actually going on board, what kinds of hierarchies and social dynamics were mapped out there. There are actually a lot of similarities between the way that these companies of various different national affiliations, including latterly the Japanese, are operating their ships. So could you give us a picture of what was going on in the ships themselves and what this said about the hierarchies, the violence, and the differentiations that were part of the semi-colonial experience?
Sure. That's that sort of twists the narrative of collaboration in a slightly different direction, but it is still there. I think that all of these companies, British companies, Chinese companies, Japanese companies, were organized in fairly similar ways. So in that sense, something like the Chinese or the China Merchant Steam Navigation Company replicates very closely the kinds of social spaces that you would see on British ships or Japanese ships as well. And I talk about both how they're similar and also sort of how some of those things are different. But the two elements of that I focused on, I mean, as a social space, a ship is pretty complex. And so I just sort of got to two of the main hierarchies there. And one is a kind of racial and technological hierarchies within steamship crews. And this was a situation, it was true in all the companies of all three nationalities, in which captains, engineers, positions of command were mostly held by foreigners. In British companies, they're held by Europeans. In Japanese companies, they're held by Japanese. In the China Merchants Company, those positions are usually held by Europeans as well. So that there's a kind of, And then all of the kind of unskilled positions on the ships of people who are shoveling coal or doing sort of standard work on the decks, those are almost invariably crews of Chinese workers, so that there's a real sort of shift and a real kind of line drawn between the kind of common, what they call the common ratings on a steamship, the sort of unskilled positions, and then this kind of hard line at which the highly skilled positions are usually held by either Japanese or Europeans. And again, I my book talks about sort of all the various reasons behind this, but what I was trying to highlight was the way in which the Chinese company in some ways needed to replicate some of these social spaces as a way of kind of competing with foreign companies. And so there's, you know, situations in which it's hard in China for a Chinese person to get the kind of technical training that would allow them to command a ship in a British ship or a Japanese ship. And so it was in some ways easier for the Chinese company to simply hire foreigners to navigate their steamships as well. And just moving on a little bit, the other hierarchy that I talk about is the way in which there's a kind of similar both class and racial hierarchy in the classes of passengers on board the ship. So generally speaking, in the steamships that I'm writing about, there are usually three classes that are set up for Chinese passengers: a first class, a second class, and a third class that have kind of different amenities and so on. But then in all of these companies, there's something called, it's usually called saloon class, or in some cases it's called sort of a special class. And that is generally the most expensive and sort of luxurious mode of travel. And generally speaking, that is reserved for either European or Japanese passengers. Now, again, part of the analysis in my book is trying to show how it's not as if somebody wrote down, you know, here's our rule, like we don't let Chinese into the foreign first class of travel. And in fact, that line can be very porous. However, there were various mechanisms that I try to outline for keeping that that sort of uppermost class of travel sort of apart from what we might think of as like the, just the local population. So that in Japanese ships, it was sort of a very, you know, they had baths and Japanese food. In European ships, it was sort of characterized by a certain sense of luxury, but also sort of European sociability as well.
Well, the teasing out the nuances of that sort of unspoken and unwritten set of hierarchies is tremendously valuable, I think, because it's through these subtle and largely or difficult to pin down hierarchies and the operation of these relationships that I guess the semi-colonial regime sort of propagates itself and sustains itself. And you document a few challenges and sort of key points at which the system became more overtly expressed because, for example, the Chinese passenger had challenged in court their right to sit in a certain part of the ship and dine in a certain part of the ship and so on. So I suppose that some of these sort of acts of resistance or these moments where conflict becomes more obvious take us forward into a more widespread phenomenon of resistance to colonial encroachment or semi-colonial encroachment as we move into the nationalist period after the collapse of the Qing. How did the collapse of the Qing in 1911 and the establishment of the People's Republic the Republic of China in 1912 change the structures and the shape and the business practices of these companies?
I would say in the first instance, you have a lot more Chinese companies that are part of the system that in the Qing, there was a way in which the Qing tried to kind of reserve this role of the kind of major steamship company for the China Merchants Company. And as you move into the Republican period, you get this sort of emergence of many of varying sizes, many private Chinese flag steamship companies, and they often do things quite differently than the China Merchants Company does. And at the same time, then you have many more, how should we say, nationalist writers criticizing what it's like to travel on these steamships, particularly the way in which Chinese passengers are, at least to their mind, very much ignored on the steamship. And then we have some, the book goes into some detail about one particular ship owner, Lu Zofu, who ran the Mincheng Shipping Company that ran out of Chongqing in the 1920s and 30s, and his attempts to actually really really reformulate that social space. It was sort of very consciously attempting to build a steamship that didn't look like any of the steamships that had come before, in that it offered, you know, more amenities to passengers in all classes, that it didn't have a separate class reserved for foreigners and so on. So you have some very kind of conscious attempts to almost to revise or reformulate that social space. And then when the Nanjing regime comes to power, they also take on the idea that they need to start training a cadre of sort of skilled Chinese navigators, which neither the Beiyang regime or the Qing state had done in a very sort of systematic way, so that they begin in the China Merchants Company, for example, it happens within the space of just a few years where they begin to essentially fire all their European captains and replace them all with Chinese who've been trained through new programs, often sometimes being trained abroad, so that there's a lot of very kind of conscious attempts to have the steamship space reflect the kind of nationalist ethics that we see emerging in that period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think you give us a great picture of how the fragmentation in the shipping market of the multiple companies, the local interests that start to develop reflect the political fragmentation and really the sort of breakup of China as a whole during that time. But I guess obviously the European companies, the British companies, and the Japanese, they don't just go away. So how was it that sort of dynamics shifted in terms of the operations relational operations between the greater number of Chinese companies that were emerging once the sort of Qing monopoly had collapsed, and the European companies that sort of stayed on the scene?
The very sort of tight conference organization that we have in the late 19th century into through say 1911 or 1913, that conference loses a lot of its power in the nationalist period because you have this kind of political fragmentation, because you have so many more private Chinese firms participating in this, that it's harder for that conference to really call the shots in the same way that it had in the past. And it opens up a lot of space for Chinese entrepreneurs to sort of use nationalism as a way to garner market share. So sometimes, I have one example of the Sanbei company, which is a well-known Chinese company from that time, using May 30th movement, the protests that come out of the May 30th movement, as a way to sort of shirk the obligations that it had entered into. It's an agreement with the larger companies, so that nationalism becomes something that can really be deployed almost as a business strategy in that period, and it opens up some more space for Chinese companies, as well as I think for the British companies, maybe a little bit less so. The Japanese companies were kind of concerned about their public image at the time, that they were also trying to make certain kinds of changes to their companies in order to appear to be somewhat less maybe imperialistic racist than they had before. Or racist. I mean, to employ more Chinese in positions of command, to sort of level some of the distinctions in the passenger classes and so on. So that they do, change practices to some degree. But again, those practices are not, I'm one of the things that it was sort of surprising for me to discover, but that a lot of the kind of social life on steamships, et cetera, is really not very official. So it's very sort of diffuse and fragmented. It depends a lot on who the captain is and how they want to run things. But there are some kind of attempts on those companies' parts to try to make their ships more sort of acceptable to Chinese passengers who are concerned about this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and looking at the sort of more on the ground, or well, I suppose on board dynamics of much bigger patterns of semi-colonial dynamics, this is something that I think is another real strength of the book, because it's so easy to sort of traffic in these grand ideas, but when you realize that individuals were kind of negotiating this in different ways, it's what brings, I guess, your theorization of these concepts that we talked about back in the introduction to life. Finally, moving forward into the conclusion, you sort of take us beyond the end of the nationalist Republic of China period, and into the early PRC. And I should say that really throughout, you've provided these excellent little kind of comparative moments with the experience of Indian colonialism, as I said, or British colonialism in India. And I think this is where it comes out again, the kind of comparison of how colonialism ended in India, and obviously there are debates over whether it ever did, but in terms of the withdrawal of British commercial interests from shipping in particular, and what happened in China. So could you say a little about how the eventual sort of withdrawal of really involved foreign interest in people in Chinese shipping networks as we moved into the People's Republic, diminished as the shipping network was decolonized, as you put it in the title of the conclusion.
So I'm trying to think of how to say this efficiently, but I think in both India and China, the idea that the shipping networks within those countries and along their coasts, the idea that those networks should belong to the ships of that nation was an idea that emerges in the early 20th century. And it's something that shipping interests in both countries fight for most of, sort of say, from the early 20th century through the moments of sort of liberation and independence in each context. So that's a kind of prolonged struggle where they're constantly making the argument that, well, we're a nation. And since we're a nation, you know, we shouldn't have foreign shipping in our internal waters. And what I think the sort of those moments of independence and liberation allow for is a kind of moment to assert that in a much stronger way than they had been able to do in the past, or basically succeed in kicking them out, in kicking foreign interests out. Of course, in China, the unequal treaties are abrogated in during the Second World War in 1943. But even after the war and as the Civil War goes on, there's still always this kind of danger that foreign shipping is going to come back because essentially China's trying to recover from the war and they're concerned that that they won't have enough ships to demobilize or to move food around and this kind of thing. And so, I mean, what happens, I think, in both places is that the state plays a very big role in controlling the shipping industry in such a way to ensure the kind of autonomy of either Chinese or Indian shipping at that time. And although, you know, we would generally tend to think of that as something that private entrepreneurs would not support. I mean, one of the arguments that I make in the book is that private shipping entrepreneurs had long desired state support in this regard. And so that there's this kind of meeting of the minds, and this happens in both China and India, where the private shipping sector really welcomes state intervention as a way of ensuring what I call in the book shipping autonomy, but as a way of making sure that foreign shipping interests don't come back just sort of necessity at that time. So again, in China, that leads rather quickly to the early 1950s, that leads rather quickly to these essentially large state-owned shipping companies. In India, there's still kind of mixed shipping scene later on into the 1950s and 60s. But the state does wind up taking over a really fairly large chunk of that sector. Does that answer your question?
Well, absolutely. No, absolutely. And it's fascinating sort of as we wrap up to see how the relatively delicate negotiations there over how to decolonize, as you put it, to kind of remove the foreign stranglehold over a lot of shipping business, and indeed, of course, Chinese customs, even what was allowed to go in and out of the country, was removed from foreign influence. How this is something that happens in this kind of delicate way, mirroring the early push and pull of semi-colonial dynamics there between the Qing and outside powers. So I think this gives the book as a whole a really forceful consistency that is fantastic. In any case, as we close up here, Anne, I'd like to thank you again for taking the time to appear. But before we let you go, perhaps I could just ask you our traditional final question on the New Books Network, namely, what is it that you are currently up to? What kind of projects do you have on the go at the moment?
Sure. Well, thanks so much. I really enjoyed talking with you about it, about the book. Right now, I'm working on another book, and it's on Lu Zuofu, who is this founder of the Mincheng Shipping Company that plays a fairly prominent role at the end of my book. And he just turned out to be a rather sort of a figure from the Republican period who sort of had his hands in a lot of different pots, I guess, at that time, so that he was sort of an important intellectual. He was a social reformer, very active in the rural reconstruction movement, as well as being this sort of big entrepreneur. And as I was doing research for the book, I kept sort of finding more and more about him that I really couldn't fit into this book in any way, shape, or form. So I'm trying to write a study of Lu that looks at some of the other areas that he was involved in. And so currently it's going to talk mostly about his involvement in rural reconstruction and his setting up of a model town in the neighborhood of Chongqing in the 1920s and 30s, as well as some of his economic thinking that, again, he was a big advocate of state planning in business, despite being essentially a private entrepreneur himself. So to look at both his economic thinking in the wartime, as well as what he came back to China after 1949 to sort of join with the PRC state in sort of reorganizing the shipping business. So I want to talk a little bit about his ideas in that regard. And then I want to extend the story because his son actually revived his company in the 1980s. It was one of the first private businesses of the reform period to be sort of emerge from the kind of Deng Xiaoping era reform period. So I also want to use this earlier story as a way to talk about how such figures are remembered and discussed in China today. So that's
wow, brilliant.
Still working on that, but that's what's coming up.
That's great. Well, that sounds really fantastic and really sounds like it will bring out another kind of new look at some of this kind of long durée developments that as I mentioned in the introduction, really bring us right up to the present and ongoing developments in China. So thank you so much again, Anne. It was great talking to you and I'm grateful for you having written the book and for appearing.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, thank you once again for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, which is a podcast on the New Books Network. We will speak to you next time. Goodbye.